this folksy nonsense.
Everyone is talking about it.
The mystery that ignited a global obsession. The girl who made headlines around the world. An innocent American abroad, or a cold and savage killer.
Did you kill Meredith?
How did things get to this point?
If I'm innocent, it means that everyone's vulnerable. And that's everyone's nightmare. Either I'm a psychopath in sheep's clothing, or I am you.
Chances are you know the name Amanda Knox. She's the American student who went to Italy for study, but ended up spending nearly 4 years in an Italian prison after being convicted of a murder she didn't commit. In fact, the Italian justice system saw Amanda Knox convicted twice and exonerated twice. In almost an instant, Amanda Knox went from being an ordinary, basically anonymous student to someone with instant global name recognition, a predicament the likes of which few experience and none aspire to. The media feeding frenzy around Amanda Knox ran the gamut of everything from tabloid sensationalism to a Netflix documentary, some of which we just heard, and even now to a thoughtful essay in the respected journal The Atlantic. The essay is titled Who Owns Amanda Knox? And its author is Amanda Knox herself. And I'm very pleased to say that Amanda Knox joins us now on Sunday Extra. Amanda, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can I start by asking you how this essay in The Atlantic came about? Did you approach them or did they approach you?
Honestly, they very kindly approached me after reading my Twitter thread.
And the Twitter thread, of course, was a commentary that you'd put out about this new American film, Stillwater, starring Matt Damon and directed by Tom McCarthy. And it's been publicized as being directly inspired by the Amanda Knox saga. Could you tell us what your thoughts were when you found out about this and what it's made you think about in terms of, I think you've described it as Tom McCartney choosing to fictionalize your story in a way that affects your reputation?
Yeah, so I wanted to start a discussion about so-called inspired by real life stories that you see being churned out in Hollywood again and again and again. And, you know, this is not the first time that people have not just used what happened to me in Italy as the sort of jumping off point for a new fictional narrative, but have used my name to then promote and publicize that fictionalized narrative in such a way that there's an automatic sort of reflection upon me, because I, for many people, am not really a person. I'm an idea of a person. And I'm very much impacted by the way that that idea of me keeps being regurgitated and consumed in new ways, particularly because what I've found is that the most salacious and less true version of what happened to me in Italy tends to be the thing that people ultimately use as that inspired by source material. And by taking that stance of, well, it's inspired by, but it's not exactly, it is fiction, they're taking the stance that they don't have to be accountable to the truth while they are still basically profiting off of the salacious, scandalous version of the story that still is a pernicious false narrative that impacts me to this day.
Yeah, so it's like the worst version of cherry picking of the
exactly
the elements of your story. I understand. I was interested to know, Amanda, have the legal outcomes in Italy, the fact that you've been exonerated not once but twice, have they had any discernible impact that you've observed on the strength of that worst sort of fictionalized, invented media villain version of you? Did what happened in the actual case change things?
I mean, it changed things for me personally in the sense that I, at a certain point, I stopped being hunted down by a terrible and false narrative. So that definitely has changed. And I've been able to sort of stop feeling like I had to react to this horrible, overwhelming experience that was happening to me, and I could try to be proactive in the world and be my own person. But what I found is that when I came home, I first of all thought, well, now that the record is set straight, maybe I can just go back to being the person I was and having the life that I had and being anonymous Amanda Knox, because I never should have been brought up as a major sort of figure in this case in the first place. And of course, what I discovered was the brutal reality that I didn't have the life that I had before to go back to. And instead, I had this whole new reality, which was that my identity was attached and inevitably linked to this traumatic, horrible event that I actually had nothing to do with. And indeed, when people think about the murder of Meredith Kircher by Rudy Gadet, they don't think of those people who are at the heart of this story. They think of me. And so anytime that I'm interacting with the world, I'm interacting with a world that sees me through that lens, and that has directly impacted me. So when people don't acknowledge that fact and instead make, you know, direct parallels to the case against me and create an Amanda Knox character that is a lazy rehash of a fiction that was woven by my prosecutor and that captivated the world enough to wrongfully imprison an innocent person, I take issue with it. And I take issue because I feel like there's this ongoing problem with recreations of true ripped from the headline stories, not just my own, where the people who are most victimized by those experiences tend to not be allowed to have authorship of their own narratives. And that's something that I've been dealing with since I had my entire adult life, basically, observing it in my own case, observing it in other people's cases. And I've had people reach out to me and to be interviewed on my podcast, Labyrinths, for instance, because they say, my identity is now being taken by others and recreated in this false light. But also, I've never had a voice in it. People want me to be this figure in a morality play that I'm not. And it's much more complicated than that. And I deeply, deeply empathize with that treatment by the media, by the criminal justice system, and by Hollywood. So in my own work, I try to do the opposite of that. I try to genuinely offer people the opportunity to author their own experiences.
On Sunday Extra, we're speaking with Amanda Knox, author of the essay in The Atlantic, Who Owns Amanda Knox? Amanda, before we come back to the really interesting questions about these sort of, you know, inspired by thinly fictionalized versions, just wanted to ask you on a personal level, was the scale of what happened to you, did that make it impossible for you to even contemplate the option of continuing to separate yourself somehow from that Amanda Knox? Was there a potential of a different approach, or was it just so overwhelming that this is yet another thing that you had no way of avoiding?
Yeah, you know, it would be one thing if the media would let me be a private person, but as someone who is considered a public figure, now my entire life is considered in the public interest, and I have no protection against that. So again, when I returned home, I was trapped in my house, surrounded by paparazzi. I couldn't go to school without being followed by paparazzi. I couldn't get married without people, you know, showing up and trying to find out and trying to sneak into my wedding. This is not something that, as someone who was a private citizen and then against my will was turned into a public figure, there's no turning back from that. And I have so much sympathy for people who, despite that, are trying to hide. Like, you know, I think Monica Lewinsky is an interesting character in this regard, because for 20 years, she was hiding. She was trying to live a private citizen's life and was denied that opportunity again and again and again. And finally had the courage and the opportunity to voice her experience. And that's a really important part of being a person, is having agency in your own life and being able to acknowledge that something that's happening to you is happening to you, not pretending that it's not happening. So, you know, this spotlight was turned on me against my desire, and I can't turn it off. I can't control that spotlight. What I can do is hold up a mirror to it. I can redirect that spotlight onto itself and onto things that matter, which is why I advocate for the Innocence Project and for criminal justice reform. And, you know, and basically what I'm trying to do is broaden the scope of, if you're going to look at me and I have no choice in that matter, I want to show you something bigger than what you think is there to see, because there is a lot to see.
Yes, indeed. And it's interesting that when you say the spotlight, it's not really a question, is it, of whether you're pro or con or what your view is of the particular case, because I was particularly interested by the exchange that you had with Malcolm Gladwell, somebody who wrote about you in a way that was very sympathetic in his book, Talking to Strangers, but at the same time, still didn't give you the agency that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and didn't acknowledge the agency of the figures that really had agency in the case. So in this episode of Labyrinths, where I talk about his examination of my case, first of all, I point out that when he did his armchair detective work and analysis of my case, he did so without reaching out to me beforehand to talk to me about it. He read my book, so he did his research, and he did have the grace and willingness to come on my podcast to talk about it. But the thing that I pointed out to him was that, in a way, by being sympathetic and acknowledging from the get-go that this is the murder of Meredith Kircher by Rudy Gaudet, this is not Amanda Knox who was not involved in this, as sympathetic as and grateful as I am for that treatment, what he did was kind of the same thing that everyone else has been doing since the beginning, which is put the explanatory burden on how other people treated me onto me to explain why I was wrongly convicted, instead of looking at all the people in that equation who had so much more power and agency to decide the course of events. So instead of doing that victim blaming, like, what did Amanda do to deserve and garner this bad attention that she received, he didn't look at the cognitive biases of these law enforcement, of the press, that were pushing these figures who had so much agency to make the decisions that they made in this case. Because honestly, from the get-go in this case, I'm kind of a boring character. I didn't really do anything. I just showed up at my house one day and called the police, and then my world collapsed underneath me. And my story is more the story of someone who has endured this incredibly surreal experience of having my identity stolen, and not just my identity, but my freedom stolen. And the thing that I wanted to point out that is especially pernicious about Malcolm Gladwell's analysis of my case is he doesn't just put the explanatory burden onto me for my own wrongful conviction, but he puts the explanatory of wrongful convictions on wrongfully convicted people. He made the suggestion that there must be a kind of person who gets wrongly convicted because they act guilty when they're actually innocent. And that is not how wrongful convictions happen. Wrongful convictions can happen to anyone, and they are the result of flawed forensics, prosecutorial tunnel vision, confirmation bias, incentivized informants. Anyone can be a victim of a wrongful conviction, and it's not appropriate to put the explanatory burden on the victim in this case.
As you point out, Amanda, at least in the case of Malcolm Gladwell, you had the chance to actually have a direct conversation with him about that. How did you feel he responded to your perspective on his book and his treatment of you? And I know you've extended the same invitation to Tom McCarthy and Matt Damon. Have you heard back from them?
So Malcolm Gladwell was open to my critiques. I think I gave him a lot of food for thought. And again, I am grateful for the opportunity to have been able to even talk with him about it. So again, kudos to Gladwell on that issue. With McCarthy and Damon, I acknowledge that they very, very likely had the best intentions in making this film and in acknowledging that they were inspired by my case in order to make it. What I've been disappointed to find is that McCarthy has kind of gone out of his way to sort of be evasive and honestly disingenuous about his treatment of me in this case, especially when he's gone out of his way to explain how he went to rural Oklahoma to hang out with, quote, roughnecks and to make sure that they represented those characters honestly. And he did not extend that same empathy work to me. And he's not name-dropping any individual person from Oklahoma in this case. And even so, I think he did the right thing by going out and finding out how his representation was going to impact those very people, how others were going to look at them. And he didn't do that same thing, even as he was specifically calling me out by name in talking about young woman, student, goes abroad, and he even says involved in a horrible crime, and I was not involved. So from the get-go, he's coming from this false supposition of who I am without even realizing it or without going through the trouble of finding out if he's making that kind of mistake. And I find that unfortunate because I was really hoping to have a genuine conversation, to build a bridge between someone who has immense power in the storytelling industry and who should understand that there are consequences to the how powerful storytellers impact real people who don't have the same privilege of storytelling.
Amanda Knox, you say that your approach now, having been through this experience, your approach to others is what you describe as extreme benefit of doubt and being very skeptical of passing on judgments about other people. Could you tell us what you mean by that and what you see as the benefits of that approach?
Well, first of all, when I go into any individual's story, I think first and foremost, who has the most at stake? Who is going to be impacted by how the story is told and why the story is being told? I try to approach anybody who I might have even deep disagreements with a sense of, first of all, trying to find common ground, trying to understand the best version of their argument, because I think most people go into any situation that they are in thinking, I'm doing the best thing that I can do in this situation. I want to have compassion for them, and I want to be willing to change my mind about whoever this person is and whatever the reasons were that they did what they did. The reason why this is so important to me is because I think the vast majority of harm that is committed against others is done out of either negligence or ignorance. I don't think that the vast majority of people who are committing harms against others are sitting in some like dark corner cackling away thinking, how can I screw over this innocent person? And indeed, when I think about what happened to me, I care not just that something bad happened to me, but I want to understand why. And if I genuinely want to understand why, I have to put myself in the shoes of the people who harmed me. And the people who harmed me, I know they don't think of themselves as bad people who were harming an innocent person. They think of themselves as good people who are doing a really difficult job. And they are clearly going to be biased, they're going to be flawed human beings, they're going to be grappling with a lot of prejudice, but that doesn't mean that they are these silly cardboard villain characters that would make for a great story. And so, you know, if I were to tell the story of my own wrongful conviction, I wouldn't be typecasting my prosecutor as this villain character who's out to get me. I don't think that that's the truth. And I think that for me, understanding why bad things happen and why harm is committed is more important than telling myself a satisfying story about how other people are bad people. And that's unfortunately the sort of Hollywood story, but I think the more interesting human story is discovering why people harm each other, even if they are with the best intentions.
Do you find upholding the ethical principles that you rightly say you found so lacking in the media that covered and consumed you, do you find that really hard to do in practice, or is it more about an intention setting that's the crucial thing?
I think, like you said, especially with Labyrinths, I do a lot of intention setting because ultimately the reality of storytelling is that there are infinite stories that you can tell. And so to say that, you know, you're hamstrung into telling a story a certain way and there's ultimately going to be consequences for, you know, you have to exploit one person or another, or one type of person or another, in order to tell your story in a way that audiences are going to respond, I don't think that's actually honest. I think that you absolutely can tell a story that doesn't come at the expense of the humanity of another person. That doesn't mean that everyone always looks good. People make mistakes, and people have really bad intentions or have really bad cognitive biases and prejudices that inform their choices, but that doesn't strip them of their humanity. So in all cases, I think that it is absolutely possible to see from the perspective of the person who, first of all, has committed a harm, but also from the perspective of victims who are very, very much overlooked in Hollywood. I mean, if you think of a story, you think of who did what, who's going to be driving the plot, who's committing the action. And victims traditionally are not doing anything. They're having things happen to them. Yeah. And so storytelling has traditionally overlooked those characters. But really, someone who is responding to an action taken at them is themselves doing a very important action that gets overlooked in especially in Hollywood. And I think those stories are very much worth telling.
Well, Amanda, it's been fascinating speaking with you about the essay Who Owns Amanda Knox. Just finally, what's life like for you now? Has anything approaching normality as we might understand it become a possibility for you?
You know, that's funny. In some ways, I have a very, very unnormal existence that is always happening. And then in other ways, I have a very normal existence. I'm married. I'm working on a family. My family is close by. I work on a podcast with my husband called Labyrinths. And so I have, you know, that normal life. And then at the very same time, there is the Amanda Knox character in the public imagination, who is this doppelganger version of me that I'm continually in conversation with. And I hope to be moving that conversation forward. Sometimes it doesn't feel that way, but I'm really grateful for this opportunity to be talking with you about this issue because, again, I think it is one that is long overdue. There's been a huge void, especially in Hollywood, about this issue, and I'm grateful for the opportunity.
Well, there's no doubt that you're having what's a very challenging conversation in a very sophisticated and engaging way. Amanda Knox, thank you so much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Amanda's essay, Who Owns Amanda Knox, is published at theatlantic.com. And Amanda, as she mentioned also, is the co-host of the podcast Labyrinths, which you can get wherever you get your podcasts.